Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, December the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump starts naming his top cabinet picks. A deeper look into Russia's cyber meddling into the U.S. presidential campaign.
The fact of the attack was not particularly surprising. Most systems are pretty easy to get into if you persist.
What was Kanye West doing at Trump Tower in New York? Also ahead, in one U.S. state, fertilized embryos are allowed to sue their parents. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, there is mixed reaction to President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State, with some current and former officials praising ExxonMobil Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Rex Tillerson, while others are expressing concern over his ties to Russia. Joining me now to talk more about it, Jamil Jaffer. He's the Director of Homeland and National Security Law at George Mason University and the former Republican Chief Counsel for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is the same committee that will be considering whether to confirm Tillerson's nomination. Jamil, thank you for being with us. So some lawmakers are concerned about Tillerson's friendly relationship with Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point. You know, I mean, look, at the end of the day, Rex Tillerson's the CEO of an American company, and he's leaving that company. And so if, as Secretary of State, he should represent the interests of the United States, and that's, I think, what he'll be expected to do. I think he'll be asked those questions. I think he'll answer them the right way. The interesting question will be, you have senators on the committee like Marco Rubio, who tweeted that being a friend of Russia is not a good qualification to be Secretary of State. So that'll be an issue of concern. You know, Rand Paul has been outspoken on some of these issues. And then off the committee, John McCain and Lindsey Graham have both indicated concerns. And so I think a lot of this will turn on how Mr. Tillerson expressed himself during the hearings. I think he'll get some tough questions, and the question will be, how will he answer them? And if he's got good answers, then, you know, it's hard to imagine prominent Republicans strongly opposing his nomination. That being said, he's going to have good answers to some tough questions.
Well, Tillerson does reportedly own about 2.6 million shares of ExxonMobil. So even if he doesn't, if he no longer is the CEO of the company, he still obviously has a stake in it.
Yeah, you know, unlike the president, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the conflict of interest laws do apply to cabinet secretaries. And so they'll have to figure that out on the ethics side, right, with his outside counsel, as well as, ethics clearance counsel in the executive branch. And then, you know, I'm sure the members of the Senate will ask the same question, and he'll have to make a decision about whether he divests or puts it in a blind trust or the like. But look, I mean, this is not the first time that a CEO has been appointed to a significant position. Most CEOs have significant stock positions. And so this is not an unusual scenario in the history of American politics, and it's one that I'm sure there are historical examples have been resolved in the past.
What do you think the outcome will be? Do you expect him to ultimately get through and be confirmed?
Well, look, the Republicans have a small majority in the Senate, only 52 votes. So if two or three or four Republicans are not supportive and the Democrats are unified in opposition, that's going to create a real problem. I think, though, you know, the general sense in the Senate is the president got elected and he gets to pick his people. That's how a Republican Senate treated President Obama's appointees, and that's generally been the tradition. Now, there is also a tradition of one or two nominees having some challenges and then, you know, maybe not succeeding. And so the question will be how this plays out. It's unusual when it's a president and a senator of the same party for most of the nominees not get through. And so we'll see what happens. I think this will really turn on the answers that Mr. Tillerson gives to these hard questions. They will get asked, and he'll have to have good answers.
All right. Jamil Jaffer, former advisor and Republican chief counsel for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that will be considering Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. Let's turn now to what's been trending on social media. We're joined by Michael Lippin. Michael, I understand one of the top trends has been on Twitter has been a rather sad and sobering one.
It is, Laura, yes. It's hashtag Aleppo, the northern Syrian city that has seen large-scale human suffering as pro-government forces get close to driving out a years-long rebellion. One Twitter user who's getting a lot of attention with hashtag Aleppo is Bana Alabed. She's a 7-year-old girl living in the collapsing rebel stronghold of eastern Aleppo. Her mother, Fatima, has been tweeting on her daughter's behalf, and those tweets are rather dramatic. In the past day, Bana's account has said, "My dad is injured now. I'm crying. And then a few hours later, my name is Bana, I'm 7 years old, I'm talking to the world now live from East Aleppo, this is my last moment to either live or die. Now there's been some skepticism on Twitter, with some people thinking that the account might be fake, but Twitter has actually verified it, and Bana's mother, who is an English teacher, has actually been interviewed from Aleppo by CNN and the New York Times in recent days.
Yeah, I saw that. It was really, it's just really heartbreaking.
It is.
I really hope she's okay.
We all do.
Let's turn now to a somewhat lighter topic. It's always busy at Trump Tower in New York these days with people coming and going and meeting
right.
the president-elect.
A lot of people.
But today, there was a surprise visitor who got Twitter into a frenzy. Tell us about it.
There was quite a frenzy. We're talking about Kanye West. He's the American rapper, record producer, and fashion designer who's got even more Twitter followers than Trump, about 26 million to 17 million for the president-elect. Now, the two men had a 15-minute meeting and then appeared in front of reporters on Tuesday, with Trump saying they were old friends and talked about life, while Kanye stood there and didn't say much at all, except that he was happy to get a picture taken with Trump. Looked a little awkward. But West then took to Twitter to explain himself, posting his first tweets in months, and he said this: "I wanted to meet with Trump today to discuss multicultural issues. These issues include bullying, supporting teachers, modernizing curriculums, and violence in Chicago. I feel it's important to have a direct line of communication with our future president if we truly want change." And Kanye's last tweet was a cryptic one, #2024. Lori, can you guess what that means?
Yeah, I think I can. He's planning on running for president. I would imagine he's assuming Donald Trump is going to get reelected after four
That's
years.
That's exactly it.
Serve two terms, and then he's going to jump in and take his place.
This is Kanye's fantasy, perhaps. He has said in the past that he would run for president in 2020, so it looks like he's
going to postpone it.
Yeah, that's how it seems. Some Twitter users, you know, appreciated Kanye's gesture in meeting Trump, but there were plenty of others who were saddened and appalled by what Kanye did, many saying that they miss what they call the old Kanye. Lori?
All right, Michael, thank you so much. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following on voanews.com. The Islamic State claims responsibility for a Cairo church bombing. A U.S. food company will pay a record criminal fine for a salmonella outbreak. Obama signs a bill to fund cancer research and drug treatment. And after Trump's win, China and Mexico move to deepen their ties. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, some top Republican congressional leaders and President Obama have actually agreed on how to approach a burgeoning issue confronting Washington, apparent Russian cyber meddling to influence the U.S. presidential election. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell endorsed investigations into this.
The activity had two parts. There was the intrusion into various parties' computer systems, and then the release of the information through WikiLeaks. The first part's actually not that hard. Most systems are pretty poorly defended, and if you have a skilled attacker, then normally they can find a way in through a variety of means. What was also interesting about this, of course, was then the release of the information through WikiLeaks into the public domain.
How surprised are you that this occurred at all?
I think it was a surprise to everyone that this tactic was used. We haven't seen that in the U.S. before, although certainly misinformation is often promulgated and compromising information is often put out around the world on lots of things. But it was surprising for most of us, I think, to see it done in the election in such a kind of a blatant way. Or the fact of the attack was not particularly surprising, as I say. Most systems are pretty easy to get into if you persist.
Do you think that it's likely still happening on some level that we are being infiltrated?
We always like to say there are two kinds of companies, two kinds of organizations, those that have been hacked and those that know they've been hacked. And so it's better to be in the second group. You can then try to fix it or at least recover from it. But in general, anybody who has valuable information online and has any public profile is subject to various kinds of cyber attacks to steal information, whether it's industrial espionage or other more political reasons or just cybercrime. So today in the cybersecurity world, we say offense wins, and we're all trying hard to make that not the case, but that's the case right now.
So do you think there are bigger national security secrets at risk as at this moment in time?
Anything that's connected to the internet is at risk. When you get to national security secrets and classified information, most of those systems, at least in the United States, are not directly connected to the internet, and they run on their own networks, so there's some more protection. But in those cases, of course, we've seen the danger from the insider threat, and in fact, the insider threat is probably underappreciated. We all like to focus on these external attacks, but as we've seen, some of the most damaging information releases have come from insiders, trusted insiders who had been fully vetted and had privileges to access the information as part of their job duties.
We have an unusual situation also now with a president-elect who likes to communicate to the American people and the world through Twitter. Do you think that Donald Trump's twittering could be a national security threat?
I don't think I would say that's the case, but I would say that I expect that as the president-elect becomes more cognizant of the job and the responsibilities and the weight of his position, that like most presidents, they tend to moderate the behavior over time, and I won't be surprised if that happens in this president-elect's case also.
And lastly, Donald Trump says that he doesn't believe that this was Russia, that he doesn't believe the intelligence, that there's no way of really knowing for sure unless you catch this type of event at the time it's occurring. What do you make of that? Do you agree?
Attribution can be hard in cybersecurity and in cyber attacks. I think that attribution problem has been increasingly solved, and not only in these cases like this one, for example, there's not only the forensic evidence, the cyber evidence, including the way the attacks were done and comparisons with other kinds of attacks, but I'm sure that the intelligence community had other evidence, non-cyber evidence, that they used to corroborate their findings, or you wouldn't have found such a unanimous point of view on this particular attribution.
And that was Bruce McConnell, the global vice president of the East-West Institute and former deputy undersecretary for cybersecurity with the Department of Homeland Security. We thank you so much for being with us to talk about how hard it may or may not have been for Russia to infiltrate the campaign. It appears President-elect Donald Trump has decided to name a one-time political foe to head the country's Department of Energy agency, which has about 100,000 employees. Aides say Trump will choose former Texas Governor Rick Perry, who once said the agency should actually be abolished. Perry is a staunch conservative, and he could shift the Department of Energy away from its recent focus on renewable energy that President Obama has championed and toward oil and fossil fuels, which Perry has promoted in oil-rich Texas. Joining me now for more on this story is Daniel Reisel. He is the environmental and energy attorney with Sive, Paget, and Reisel in New York. It's the oldest environmental law firm. Thanks so much for being with us. So how unusual is this pick, given it's someone to head an agency that he once said he thought maybe we should do away with?
Not unusual if you really believe that Trump has an agenda that is anti-regulation, which often translates out to be anti-environment. So in that sense, it's not unusual, but you would think at this stage of our country, but I mean, if you really want to open up land for exploitation, public land, and you want to facilitate the extraction of carbon, then, of course, you're going to put somebody who is a non-regulator in charge of a regulatory agency. You would have hoped that the Department of Energy would facilitate your wind and air resources, your renewables. And that, of course, is something that the oil and gas industry has opposed for some time. They are usually in opposition to the development of these facilities or subsidizing it. And I expect that that's what you'll see.
What does the Energy Department do? What is its job?
It's basically is to promote, federal energy policy, which has concentrated on, as of late, on renewable resources.
So I guess that would make sense that it's totally related to climate change issues.
Climate change is one of the central victims of this transition to the Trump administration.
The department received a questionnaire about which employees had worked on climate change issues in the Obama administration. And I know that there were some employees that raised concerns about it. They were uncomfortable with it. And ultimately, this questionnaire was answered, but no employees' names were given. Do you have any idea what the concerns might have been regarding this?
You know, the concerns were that if you were a climate change activist in government services, you were not going to be favored with the same type of job that you had before, that you would be shifted out of positions, and if you weren't protected by civil service status, you'd be canned. It seems to me to be an effort to intimidate and squelch. You know, it's an opening gun and squelching, a interest in climate protection. And the fact that they asked for associations, personal associations, what they belong to, is a much more intimidating factor.
What do you expect the department to look like with a leader that potentially doesn't believe in climate change? And how much change could he actually make to the progress that's already been made?
I think the key is that projects for renewables are not going to be encouraged. They're not going to be subsidized in any way. And there's not going to be planning, and there probably will not be, an active program to facilitate carrying out the Obama goals of moving to renewables. And you won't have a favorable structure to promote renewables, but you will have a favorable structure, and they'll do everything they can do to promote the extraction of coal and oil.
One thing I did see, though, that Rick Perry did as governor in Texas was to build up wind farms, which would sort of contradict some of these other things.
It certainly would, and if he, he could surprise us.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Environmental and energy attorney Daniel Reisel, thank you for your time. We also should note that Rick Perry's been a vocal critic of man-made climate change during his tenure as Texas governor. As we said, he did turn the state into a major producer of wind energy. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Here's a new one. TV show Modern Family star Sofia Vergara is being sued by two frozen embryos of hers in an unusual lawsuit as part of a three-year battle by her ex-fiancé to see the embryos brought to life. The female embryos, which were created by Vergara, were created when she was engaged to businessman Nick Loeb, and they're listed as plaintiffs in this lawsuit filed in Louisiana in a state court. Joining me now for more on this unusual case is Los Angeles family attorney Ed Lyman. Wow, tell us about it.
The state of Louisiana allows embryos to have a certain statutory status, embryos that would be equivalent as to the rights and obligations of a corporation. And they passed a law allowing embryos to have what would be called a judicial person status. So they would be equated with a judicial person. That law comes out of their statutes from 1986. And it's been on the books for a very long time there.
What's the background with that?
So Nick Loeb and Sophia Vergara, they were engaged, and then later, probably some issues having children, they went to a fertility clinic in Beverly Hills and entered into an agreement there to have her eggs fertilized in vitro, and there were two female embryos created at that time. And since then, they had broken up. And now she wants to say, well, let's keep these embryos frozen indefinitely. And Mr. Loeb's position is that that's tantamount to destroying them, basically, and ending their lives. So he had filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles County last year, but he did file this month. He filed to dismiss that on his own. What we saw recently is a new lawsuit, not necessarily him as a plaintiff, but the embryos as a plaintiff and the trustee of their trust filing in Louisiana, where it's a much more favorable jurisdiction for embryos. Louisiana has a law in the books that prevents the destruction of frozen embryos.
Then if you don't freeze the embryos, what do? Incubate them and allow them to be born?
And that's a great question. That's an issue that is not even addressed in the lawsuit at all. It's like he just wants an order that the agreement is that they're allowed to sustain their current status and not necessarily be fully developed. So he's not asking for a court order in that case, in that situation, but he would like the embryos to just stay alive, I guess, indefinitely as they're frozen.
Is this the first of its kind that you know of, that an embryo, an unborn human being, can sue its mother?
I think this is a very creative way. We see the law being stretched there in Louisiana to have these embryos have some kind of standing to sue their mother. And, you know, as you know, anybody can walk down to the courthouse and sue. It doesn't mean the lawsuit's going to be successful. So that's a unique issue, as well as whether the embryo has standing to actually even sue the mother under the states and trust law from Louisiana.
Where do you see this going?
There's an epidemic basically going on with all these frozen embryos, especially in places like Louisiana, where a clinic's not able to necessarily destroy the embryos. So there is that problem, and a lot of lawyers have to deal with this commonly. Is like, what are we supposed to do if we represent a fertilization clinic, for example? Mm-hmm. What are we going to do if the parties never agree to have their embryos destroyed? We're not allowed to in Louisiana. But another big issue with this case is it's my understanding the embryos are located here in California at a fertility clinic in Beverly Hills. So how would the embryo have the ability to even enter court in Louisiana if they don't even exist in that state? You know, we see commonly is what happens once these parents are unable to pay for the service anymore, you know, and they let their contract with the fertility clinic lapse, then they have the issue of going to continue to pay every month for the storage fees. So then you have millions of frozen embryos out there with no disposition right now. Like, what are we going to do with this? So it's becoming a crisis in that sense as well.
All right. Unusual, that's for sure. We'll see how this ends up. Los Angeles family attorney Ed Lyman, thank you for being with us. Well, a new hit single pairs a pop singer and a rapper. Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us more about it.
Camila Cabello, who is a pop star in her own right with the band Fifth Harmony, she's done another solo single. A year ago, she recorded a song with Shawn Mendes called I Know What You Did Last Summer. But she's back now with this duet with Machine Gun Kelly. The new song is called Bad Things. There have been rumors circulating that Fifth Harmony might be breaking up. And another member of the group is releasing a solo song as well. But the girls in Fifth Harmony, who were discovered on X Factor on TV, maintain that they're not breaking up. Just like One Direction, they may be trying solo stuff along the way, but they have no plan to disband Fifth Harmony. So we've got Machine Gun Kelly, Camila Cabello. The hit is called Bad Things, and it's just arrived in the top 10 on the Billboard charts, so it's worth listening to.
Am I out of my head? Am I out of my mind? If you only knew the bad things I like, don't think that I can't explain it.
What can I say? It's complicated. No matter what you say.
Okay, there seem like nowadays there are a lot of combinations of groups getting together and, you know, trying different venues, that kind of thing.
Well, that is, you're absolutely right. It's happened for many, many years that people record duets, but these days you've got mixing genres together. You've got pop and country, you've got EDM and country, which is very different to have, you know, electronic dance music sound mixed with a country artist, but they did it successfully earlier in the year with Lady Antebellum. But now Camila Cabello, Machine Gun Kelly, he's a rapper, she's a pop star with Fifth Harmony. The band is on tour right now. I had a chance to interview both of them last night, and you'll be hearing that on Border Crossings. But I spoke with both of them who were here in D.C. for a big music festival called the Jingle Ball. And Machine Gun Kelly, very excited to have his album out, doing so well. He's a tall guy, and he told me he wants to get into acting. He said he hasn't been the best father. This Christmas, he hopes to be a better father. He's going to make it up to his son. Camila Cabello, meanwhile, she is one of Taylor Swift's Girl Squad members, one of Taylor's best friends. She also was on Time Magazine's list of the top 30 under 30. She's only 19. Made a lot of money this past year with Fifth Harmony, and she's off to do good things because she's very, very talented. Great singer, performer. She suffers from anxiety, though. This past summer when Fifth Harmony were on tour in St. Louis, she ran off the stage. Oh. And the band said, oh, she'll be back. She never came back for the rest of the show, and later they explained it as an anxiety attack, panic attack. She suffered those throughout most of her life, so it hit her while she was performing. But I asked her about it last night. She said she's fine. She takes medication to kind of calm things down, and she's doing just fine.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's VOA's Larry London, the host of Border Crossings.
Nothing's that bad if it feels good. So you come back like I knew you would. And we're both wild and the night's young. Enjoy my drug, breathe you into my face, numb. Drop it down to that bass drum. I got what you dream about. Nail scratching my back tat. Eyes closed when you scream out and you keep me in with those hips. Why my teeth taking those lips? Why you...
You've been listening to International Edition. That's going to do it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nicole Beckford, and engineer, David Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With the stroke of a pen and a decisive vote by Colombia's Congress, the longest-running conflict in the Western Hemisphere ended. On November 24th, Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos, and Rodrigo Londoño, commander of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, signed a peace agreement, and on November 30th, Colombia's Congress approved the accord. It was a difficult process and a long time coming. 4 years of difficult negotiations led to the first signing of an agreement in late September, which both sides hoped would end Colombia's 52-year internal conflict. But 6 days later, the Colombian people rejected the agreement by a narrow margin. Many voters felt it did not go far enough to hold FARC members accountable for their past actions. So it was back to the negotiating table for both sides, where a revised version of the document was agreed upon. On November 30th, Colombia's Congress voted to approve the revised accord. It now includes a requirement that FARC members declare and hand over all of their assets to pay for reparations to victims. FARC members must also declare the full truth about their involvement in drug trafficking. The agreement further defined the restrictions of liberty for those who committed crimes against humanity, and it clarified that the accord will not be incorporated into Colombia's constitution as had been previously proposed. The United States welcomes the approval of the peace accord, which we believe will help achieve a just and lasting peace for all Colombians, said Secretary of State John Kerry. The Colombian people deserve enormous credit for their persistence, commitment, and focus in this endeavor. Special recognition must go to President Juan Manuel Santos, who has earned the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts, he said. Our Paz Colombia initiative, aimed at supporting continued institutional development, aiding conflict victims, removing landmines, combating narcotics, and addressing remaining security issues, is designed to help our Colombian partners achieve the lasting peace that they have fought so hard for and that they so richly deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.